That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before.
Today's guest on Nature Bats Last is Dr. Andrew Glickson. Dr. Glickson is an earth and paleoclimate scientist, visiting fellow at the School of Archaeology and Anthropology at the Australian National University, and author of a recent book titled The Pleistocene, Blueprints for a Post-Anthropocene Greenhouse Earth. Today's show is a call-in show. US listeners can call 8888-74888. Overseas callers can dial 01-60-556-25119. Andrew, welcome to Nature Bats Last.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, sir. I'd like to discuss a number of the issues you've canvassed in your latest book, including the prospects of us facing a nuclear winter and leaving the planet bathing in ionizing radiation, an order of magnitude greater than what we've already released into the atmosphere, oceans, and land masses. Would you like to start there, sir?
Yeah, sure. What is the question?
Well, just tell us about how you think we're going to make this transition from where we are today to the post-Anthropocene greenhouse Earth.
Well, I don't have any magic insight into the future. I'm looking at what's happening at the present time. And what's concerning is that many people are not aware of the trends of the twin existential dangers of global warming or climate disruption and of the nuclear threat. We have been aware of the nuclear threat now since World War II, but as to the pace and the scale of climate change, I think many people have only woke up to it, well, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. And the writing has been on the wall in the sense that in terms of a nuclear threat, well, it's still a question of the probability of it happening. And I feel the probability is very high. It's, many people are saying it now. In terms of global warming, which is more in my field, I fear the train has left the station.
I'm tragically agreeing with you 100%. You wrote an open letter to the Australian government and received no reply. I sent my blog post to various members of the New Zealand government about the oil giants Shell and BP having been caught discussing in internal emails a temperature rise of 5C by mid-century. This was exposed in an article published in the British newspaper The Independent on the 27th of October last year. A lot of us have talked generally about the fact that industrial civilization won't be able to survive a 4 degrees C temperature increase. Could you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, before I do that, I'd just like to comment. The letter was signed by 204 scientists and sent to the Prime Minister. It was not published by most mainstream media, only by a couple of minor ones, so there appeared to be some degree of cover-up. As to a reply from the Prime Minister, after some weeks we did get a formal reply. It does not really address our concern, only cites the official line. Now, you're asking about the transition, right?
Correct.
Well, I feel we are looking at a transition now. Every parameter, as far as the climate is concerned, is actually rising up. But it's not a linear rise. It's a jagged line. The variability, rather, is increasing, which means you get heat waves, but you also get cold snaps, such as you see now in Northern Europe and so on. And that's because the Arctic is melting, and the stratospheric jet stream is also modified, changing, and allowing cold air to be injected from time to time to the south. And in reverse, you get the extreme warming of regions such as the Gulf of Mexico, and you get the Gulf Stream and North Atlantic thermohaline current going north, but that's now starting to get aborted by the flow of cold water, excuse me, from the melting of the Greenland ice sheet.
Yes, you mentioned that in the book about the AMOC, or the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, slowing down, and the fact that it has done so in the past. How abruptly could that flow stop?
Well, when we look at what happened in the past, we look at what's called the Younger Dryas period between 12,900 and 11,700 or thereabouts. It lasted for about 1,000 years plus. When you look at that, measurements of Greenland ice drill cores shows that the onset and also the termination were very abrupt. Changes can be extremely abrupt due to reinforcing or reamplifying of the effects, such as once water freezes, then they continue to freeze. Once they melt, they continue to melt. It's a pace of which can take, well, perhaps only a few years.
One of the things that I've noticed as we go down this journey together, studying the unraveling of the biosphere, is that climate scientists always refer back to previous extinction events and previous events. And I wonder, is that sometimes underestimating the speed of this unraveling due to the fact that we've released billions of years of stored carbon in only a couple of hundred years? Is it possible that we could be in the middle of an event that's faster than any previous one?
That's right. It's the rate and the scale combined which are the great worry. Organisms, species can adapt to relatively slow changes, and they have in the past most of the time, with exceptions of the periods which are known as the great mass extinctions. But when the parameters, when the climate, temperatures, and so on change rapidly, and they are changing very rapidly now, then species don't have the time to adapt and get extinct. Obviously, some of them get extinct, other ones survive. But this is very much the nature of the previous mass extinctions, which were caused by large-scale volcanic activity and by impact by asteroids and comets. The rate, the scale, and the rate which we're looking at now is virtually unprecedented, at least since 55 million years ago. And in a way, it's even faster than that. It's 55 million years ago, which is called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. Temperatures, global temperature rose by approximately 5 degrees, perhaps a bit more. But it still took perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 years for them to rise at that stage. This caused a mass extinction, and some species disappeared, mostly plankton, and other ones appeared. Well, what we're looking now, because we are in the eye of the storm, in some places things are happening extremely fast, like the extreme weather events, the hurricanes in the Caribbean and in Southwest Pacific. But in other areas, life continues more or less as usual. So it's confusing, and some people realize, people get hit. Like, well, the fires, for example, in California, in Southern Europe, and other people in other centers wonder what it's all about. All they know, they just see it on television and switch the channel off.
You've been discussing in different interviews and papers that I've read from you recently about scientific reticence, where scientists aren't prepared to speak up about the severity of the crisis. Dr. James E. Henson is saying the same thing. Is it cognitive dissonance or is it malpractice?
Yeah, that's very true. James Henson has raised the issues. I'm fully aware of it. People want to live today and the next day. The issue is so big, it's overwhelming, and also there are real-life consequences, whether it's scientists, environmentalists. If you're in some position, say in government and so on, and you become a whistleblower or unspoken, sometimes you will realize the consequences in terms of whether it's promotion or whether even your security of your position. Besides, people don't like to find themselves in a Cassandra role. You know, Cassandra was given a foresight by the gods, and she was telling people about it, but everybody was moving away. That's a very common social and psychological response, which climate scientists realize and experience. So they're being careful, perhaps too careful.
I understand that phenomenon completely. Talking about the things that we discuss and the collapse of everything we know and love and hold dear is a very alienating experience. I found that where people have this manic attachment to hope, irrespective of whether there is any or not. I'm always being told that I'm being too dire and my prognosis is too horrible, and it's not leaving hope for people. But I think if you go to a doctor and you get a diagnosis of late stage pancreatic cancer, he doesn't have any help to give you. All you can do in that situation is live the best and the most fulfilling life you can do at that moment. And that's sort of my mantra. I just think that I don't do this and I don't talk about how dire this is because I like it. I do it because I operate on the basis that if I was walking past your home and I saw it was on fire, I have a moral obligation to give you the bad news, whether you want to hear it or not.
Well, that's right, yes. There are people who have what I would call an optimistic gene, and also they realize that if they become doom and gloom conveyors, then this doesn't lead them anywhere. People will move away. I can think of quite a number of people who have optimistic genes. One of them will be Al Gore. His message is always positive, or tends to err on the positive. The other one is Tim Flannery, and the other ones, at least in the public expressions, they emphasize the hope and what can be done. And they probably have to, from point of view of the effect of the message which they're trying to convey. Scientists, well, they tend to... There is a lot of psychology associated with this situation, but essentially scientists tend to just present the evidence as they see it. And because the evidence is so serious, so dire, climate scientists find themselves in a difficult situation. Many of them just they write their papers, they give their lectures, but they try and avoid too many public expressions on the side of, well, on the side of despair. So once you inject your feelings, your sentiments, your emotions into presentation of the evidence, you're bound to either become what's called an alarmist, even though I don't accept this term, because if you present evidence the best you can, then it's your duty to do so, or some err on the side of hope. It's a very fine balancing act, and I certainly find myself in that situation.
Yeah, I totally get that. I'm in that position. I don't have the credentials that you have, but I study and research full time on abrupt climate change, and I listen to the scientists, the broad spectrum, and I try and join the dots between what they're saying and where we're going. There is a contentious scientific theory that the planet may have warmed one time before 5 degrees C over a 13-year period. What's your take on the possibility of that happening?
Well, it has, but in most cases it has taken, well, maybe 2, 3, sometimes 4,000 years. And we're talking here about the relatively more recent paleoclimate events. You're talking here about the glacial-interglacial cycles, the ice ages and the interglacials. They change between them, like they rise from deep glacial to interglacial, which was approximately 4 or 5 degrees. That happened over several thousand years, well, 3 or 4. And species could adapt. Still, this were huge upheaval in terms of, certainly in terms of human history. But now we're looking at forecasted similar changes within a century or two. That's almost, it almost belongs to the unthinkable. And scientists and everybody, even though they look at the IPCC forecast, which are at, well, maybe 4 degrees a century, the full meaning of such extreme rapid rise is very hard to comprehend.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing, and I can understand why people turn away and look in the other direction. I've just read the latest book, The Pleistocene Blueprints for a Post-Anthropocene Greenhouse Earth, and in a lot of places in the book there is poetry that is relevant to each chapter. Is that your way of trying to humanize such a horrendous story and get people to relate to it via the arts?
Yes, exactly. That's where I express the way I feel about the issue through these poems. I didn't want to have a completely dry scientific evidence-based book, but it is. The chapters are this way, but before or ahead of the chapters, I sometimes insert some of the poems which I've written, which express the way I feel about it. So, like you say, it's to humanize the book.
Oh, I found it very, very humanizing and very gratifying to be able to make those connections between those two different, well, you know, a science and an art. It was really really refreshing, I found.
Well, yes, indeed. The way which scientists feel, the way which I feel, it's all inside. I mean, we really don't want to say too much about it because, well, if I, for example, wanted to really express the way I feel about what's happening, and the apathy and the untruth and the cover-up and the denial, which you see especially among the political classes, I would have to go and stand in front of Parliament and just scream and scream and scream and scream. But obviously I can't do it, I won't do it, and it will not have any positive effect. So instead of this, I talk to these people and I try and present and explain the evidence, and many of them understand it, but I think they're all tied with umbilical strings to the party policies. They're not free to, or they don't feel they're free to stand up and say exactly what they think in parliament and to the people, because they will lose their positions and so on. And that's where the crux of the problem is, that even the people who understand, many of them don't have the courage to express the way they what they really think about the issue.
And also there's the factor that there's an old edge about it being hard to get someone to understand something that calls into question their ability to earn money. So I think, you know, there's this problem where everyone in the science field who is looking for grant money for projects, they're in the same position where they have to be careful what they pitch for and what they say, because there's no money in extinction.
Well, that's right. But then it seems to be money is the underlying motivation for so much of what's happening. It's time to stand up, but I am just, I can't believe it, how rare it is that people in position of power, even those who understand what's happening, do not take a stand, and even at the risk of perhaps losing some position or other, do not take a stand and just say exactly what they think.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed with a lot of people when it comes to such things. One example of that was I've been a huge supporter of Dr. Michael E. Mann, you know, since 1989 when he spoke to Congress effectively. And him and his colleagues came up with the hockey stick theory about how everything will ramp up once we cross tipping points. And now all of our graphs look like that. We seem to have crossed a multitude of tipping points, and now no one speaks about tipping points anymore. No one speaks about the hockey stick graph.
Well, actually, the tipping point is real in terms of the measurements of paleoclimate, recent climate, and what's happening at the present time. The tipping point is difficult to define in day-to-day life because it depends where you are. If you are in the eye of the storm, you will not know what's happening around. But if you are in the storm, well, people will not hear you any longer. Like, will this event, this series of hurricanes in the Caribbean, but also in the Philippines and the Southwest Pacific, it has destroyed communities and people's lives. And yet, well, people in other parts of the world watch it on television and switch off. It is happening, but not everybody is aware until it actually reaches home. And it does. I mean, you get the fires, including here in Australia, you had huge fires here. But it always seems, or rather that's what the media tells you and the politicians, they say 1 in 100 years. They're not telling the truth, because the rate and the scale of extreme weather events has been rising and rising and rising. It has been monitored by, among other, insurance companies. So the whole phenomenon is people don't want to believe it until and unless it reaches home. And by the time it reaches home, well, it's a little bit late to do very much.
I love your analogy of being in the eye of the cyclone. I'm an ocean sailor. I've done 16 ocean passages on small cruising yachts under 90 feet. By small, I mean under 90 feet. And one time I was holed up in a remote bay, and there was a catastrophic, very, very bad storm blowing, but I had no VHF or cell phone coverage, and I didn't have any satellite communications on the boat. So I didn't know what was happening. All I knew was that there was a terrible storm. And then it started clearing up, and I watched the barometer rise, and my wife and I decided we would go somewhere else, and we sailed out. This is the epic fail of my sailing career. I sailed out into a cyclone. Because I was lured into thinking, you know, because it had gone quiet, I was lured into thinking that the storm was abating, whereas in reality it was I was just in the middle of it.
Well, I really envy your experiences. I wish I had any similar experiences like this, because I haven't been sailing very much. I'm actually, by training, I'm a geologist, and been going bush into the outback just about every year over the past many years. Yes, I admire people like you and what you do, and you are right at the front of what's happening, and it's good for the soul. At least when you try and do something and venture out, you know that you are not accepting this threat, the danger of lying down. You are taking a stand, and you can keep your integrity and your self-respect.
Thank you very much. One of the first things that triggered me to the severity of our crisis was, first of all, I was at the Tokyo fish market one dawn many years ago, and I walked in to see how much fish was being sold that day in Tokyo, and I burst into tears. I was standing there looking across it, and it just dawned on me that this was unsustainable. This is 30 years ago. And I knew instantly that we could not carry on vacuuming that number of fish out of the oceans. And then later on, as my offshore sailing career developed, one of the things I noticed was the flying fish disappeared. When I first started doing ocean passage making, we would see heaps of flying fish. Often they'd hit the sails or hit the side of the boat, and we'd go and scoop them up, and it was the easiest fishing I've ever done. But over that time, they disappeared. And my initial worry or my initial thought was that it would be due to overfishing. Then I delved into it more, and what I realized was that overfishing is an issue, but ocean acidification is a huge player in this as well. And, you know, you know better than me that maybe 80% of the carbon and warming that we emit is absorbed into the oceans, and it's becoming more acidic. What do you think are the chances of us facing Canfield oceans before too long?
Well, it's happening now, like you've been observing it. This is mass extinction in our lifetime. What do I think? Well, it's a combined threat of ocean warming, like to the Great Barrier Reef, and acidification and overfishing and these walls of death and God knows what else. Question is, how long can it go before civilization is unable to continue with its destructive activities? I tend to think that it's between 2 and 3 degrees and so on. The combination of extreme weather events, sea level rise, which threatens some very large industrial areas in northeast China and in Europe and so on, will affect the ability of industry to continue with its destructive activities. So nature will take care of what's happening in that way, but it will be a very terrible way for us, because it will mean that food production will decrease and many people will be even hungrier than they already are. I mean, all the signs are already there, this mass migration of people, whether it's the Rohingya or whether it's the Syrian, and as sea level rise, it will have to be Bangladesh and even Egyptian in the Delta areas and the Mekong and so on. Sea level rise is a real threat now. I mean, it has been, but it tends to accelerate as the large ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are collapsing.
You mentioned the Great Barrier Reef, and we've witnessed in the last few years the worst bleaching event ever to strike the Great Barrier Reef. And a little known fact about Cyclone Winston, which was the first Category 5 cyclone to ever hit Fiji, it tracked across the Coral Sea and dumped a large amount of cold water on the Great Barrier Reef, which mitigated the bleaching event. The Australia Bureau of Meteorology could slip into another El Nino event this autumn, this Southern Hemisphere autumn. I believe that the Great Barrier Reef is in hospice now, and that the next serious El Nino could be the death knell for it. And yet in Australia, there's so much money derived from tourism around the Great Barrier Reef that no one seems to be talking. Well, not no one. There are a few scientists that have been very, very frank about the situation. But the government in Australia, the cognitive dissonance is spectacular. They have one of the world's most spectacular oldest and largest living organisms on their coastline, and they continue to mine coal. And they even wanted to build the Adani mine and railway line and ship it across the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, so what's happening is criminal, really. Australia, as you know, is a world-scale miner and exporter of coal. And it's this many tens of billions of dollars, which, once again, it comes to money. These people, they either don't understand or don't want to understand, or they're just bound to vested interest. But what worries me even more is that the population seems to be only partly aware. Relatively few people go to protests and marches and so on. When you look at, they go to football games and cricket games and casinos and all the rest of it, they fly around the world. When you look at what people do, you start to understand that the politicians just represent what many people actually are doing. If people were more aware and more proactive and had greater courage, this might not have happened. You look at history, and great movements and revolution happened when people could not put food on the table. Well, in our technological society, the situation has not reached that level yet, not for what you call the middle classes. So life goes on from day to day. People are captive to day to day, and captive also to the electronic world, to this. They are trapped in the electronic medium to the extent that reality, or the concept of what reality is, has changed, including for many young people.
I totally agree with that. What I see is that there's been this change on the planet where all of these electronic devices have arrived in the last 20 years, and the new generation are completely addicted to them. And even old people like me, I have to admit, you know, I spend a hell of a lot of time online because that's where I do my research. When I was a young fella, I would go to the library. Now my library is on a keyboard, and I search it there. So I do, but I also think that that's a failure of the Fifth Estate. When we were younger, there was a lot more independent media, and now the bulk of the world's media are owned by a few corporations, and they're the very same corporations that are grinding the living planet into dust. It's hardly likely that they're going to tell us.
Yes, well, the media is responsible to a huge extent responsible for what's happening. I mean, not even talking about the right-wing media, even the so-called moderate central media, and they report the events, but at least in Australia, they have not, to a large extent, made the connection between extreme weather events and between global warming. They still talk about once in 100 or 50 years. It's all happening like almost haphazard, and they don't... they don't combine the dots. And so people think, well, it's just bad luck. But in fact, it's a trend, and it's a global trend. The media has been guilty of not emphasizing it, or not emphasizing it enough anyway.
Oh, that is what I see my role going forward is to join the dots between all these things and not look at anything in isolation, because nothing happens in isolation. Everything is linked. Could we have a discussion about an issue that is really close to my heart and annoys me? And that is, I'd like to know, what is your position on the shifting baseline, which we calculate global temperature? I believe because we ignore the anthropogenic warming prior to the 1980s, and overall climate sensitivity has been underestimated, we are misrepresenting how far down the road we already are.
I think you're right, yes. We're underestimating it and just continue to live from day to day and hope for the best. But when you look at the trends, I mean, there's so many untruths around on websites and in the media that it's unbelievable. And people don't want to believe what is too hard, what is the unthinkable. And again, you can be in the center of the storm, and you still hope that it will not touch you. But it will. I mean, all of the things are true, and all of the things have been written about. There's some vast literature about what's happening now. But it's not the literature which most people read or want to read.
Yeah, it's not what anyone wants to hear. They want to carry on just like the capitalist system wants to carry on with business as usual. Business as usual. I think it's a situation of the can being kicked down the road, and it's been kicked down the road since 1847, when George Perkins Marsh gave the first lecture that I'm aware of that about how burning carbon would warm the atmosphere. We've been talking about it now for a very long time, and any serious action has always been postponed for some time off in the future. We see when all the politicians came back from COP out 21 in Paris, and we're all lauding the merits of the agreement just because they got an agreement. But the reality is that the agreement was to do nothing mandatory and effectively kick the can down the road. And, you know, that's why we're in the trouble we're in at the moment.
Well, it's a fig leaf, this agreement. It's certainly pacified many people. But there is an even bigger question now. If they decided, if the powers to be globally decided to do something about it, what can they do now? Yes, of course, you have to limit and even abruptly reduce emissions. There's no doubt about that. But the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is already so high that it's self-amplifying. Like when the oceans warm, they can absorb less carbon dioxide. When the land desiccates and dries, then there are lesser green plants which can absorb the CO2. Methane is released from permafrost at an enormous rate. What can they do? Well, CO2 drawdown is the answer in principle, and it's known on a small scale can be done. But to do it on the required scale, it's to downdraw billions of tons of CO2 every year. Well, this requires budget on the scale of what's invested in the military. But that's not happening. It seems that money and conflict and war are dominant in our world. And instead of defending life on the planet, what they're doing is creating even greater nuclear monsters, which now threaten life from another angle. I mean, the whole thing, when you think about it, it makes you tear your hair off and just want to go away. But I think, well, there is a duty for people like you and people like me to keep on presenting the evidence to people. Whether it has an effect, I'm at this stage not particularly optimistic, I have to admit.
I believe that anyone who knows how bad the situation is has a moral obligation to speak up. And I use the analogy of pointing out that your house is on fire. I think this is a really important thing for young people, because all my life I've been an activist and I've been trying to solve a whole lot of these issues. I've been an anti-nuclear activist since I was 19. We played a tiny little part in getting New Zealand made nuclear free, and that was an achievement. That was a victory. We fought the anti-apartheid struggle in New Zealand, and we played our part in seeing the end of apartheid. Those are important victories. We're not going to be able to solve this predicament. We're so far over the cliff and heading into Armageddon that it is what it is. But we still can be honest about it, and we can still take the pressure off young people by saying to them, I think it's wrong for anyone to say to the next generation, they have to fix this problem that we've. There's no fixing it. They have to do the best they can for themselves and prepare the best they can for the coming chaos. But I think it's morally indefensible to tell young people that they have to fix the unfixable.
Well, that's right. And we have to answer to ourselves, and you are clearly doing it. And so good on you. Once you've done all you could, at least you develop some degree of peace of mind that you have done all you could do, and good on you. whether it's going to have effect out in the world, well, who knows? I hope you have optimistic genes. I wish I did. It certainly helps with this situation. And otherwise, except for that, life has always been in the present, even in the so-called good old times. Well, my grandparents lived through World War One. My parents lived through World War Two. There have been horrible, horrible situations in the past, so we are not unique in this respect. It's only that we have now this global outlook, whereas people in the past had perhaps a more regional one. But given all that, life has always been for the moment, for the present, and that's a way of trying to cope.
It's all we can do at this stage, I'm afraid. In your writing, you've gone into a lot of detail about the fact that we've already left the planet bathing in ionizing radiation, and that after the collapse, we will see nuclear power station meltdowns. And because of the psychopathy of a lot of the people who are involved in the military-industrial complex around the world, there's a high chance that we'll suffer from having a nuclear exchange in anger, which so far we haven't had. We've only had one nation drop a few nuclear bombs on civilians in Japan, but we haven't had a full-on nuclear war. I'd like to ask you, what do you think the chances of a nuclear war or the meltdown of those 450 nuclear power stations and their attendant spent fuel pool fires, what do you think are the chances of that stripping away the atmosphere completely?
Oh, they will not strip the atmosphere completely. The book contains a number of examples of near calls, close calls over the last 60, 70 years as far as nuclear exchange is concerned, just by accident. The possibility of accident is just as high as that of deliberate nuclear war. I think deliberate nuclear war is possible, but an accident is even more so, because once they have set up all these systems, they set themselves to the probability of accident has been always very high. And when you have tensions, political tensions now between the superpowers, the possibility is even higher. And once it starts, it's hard to imagine how it can be stopped. What do I think about? I think it would be a mistake to think that the planet itself is in danger. The planet has undergone and faced huge mass extinctions in the past. There have been lulls, periods of which the level of biological activity has declined dramatically. But some species have always adapted, and after such a hiatus, life came back again. So the planet itself is not in danger. Humans are in danger, but I also tend to think that there will always be some humans surviving in certain niches, ecological niches, especially in the north, where temperatures still, even though they're rising faster than anywhere else, temperatures in the north will still remain within breathable range or limits. So this total scenario of atmosphere being stripped and so on, I cannot see that. What I can see is that civilization itself might collapse, and we become a scenario of warring tribes, people trying to survive here, there, and everywhere on a local basis.
Compared to me, you've got the optimistic gene. That's my gallows humor slipping in, I'm sorry. Andrew, what do you think of this nuclear psychopaths who have their finger on the nuclear button? What do you think of the chances of them deliberately starting or using nuclear weapons to create a nuclear winter scenario?
Well, the nuclear scenario is now in the newspaper just about every day with regard to North Korea. But it can spread very easily. Once nuclear bombs explode, the response, use them or lose them kind of scenario, its side will wants to preserve their capacity to fire nuclear missiles, but because they are threatened by the other side, they might shoot them anyway. So you're asking, what do I think? I try not to think too much about the consequences because it belongs to the unthinkable. I realize that it can happen. It can happen every day. It can happen now. I mean, you probably know about that film on the beach.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a fantastic American journalist staying at my house recently. His name is Daj Jamail. He writes at truthout.org. And every morning, you know, it was actually last year he stayed with me. And he every morning when he got up, he'd open his computer, turn it on, and then he'd turn to me and say, "Hey, great news, Kev, nuclear war hasn't broken out while we've been asleep." You know, that's how tenuous the situation is when you have these alpha males with the nuclear button in their hand.
Well, they want to win the war the way which Reagan has. They have put so much pressure on the Soviets at that stage in the 1980s, 90s, that the Soviet economy collapsed. And in fact, it's ceased being socialist or anything. It's become as capitalist, you can say, as any other system. And it's now clear that the conflict was not an ideological one. It doesn't matter what the political system. It can be capitalist, socialist, fascist, communist. Big powers or even medium powers tend to compete rather than cooperate. There are cycles. Now we are, 70 years since World War II, and people have forgotten, or the young generation have forgotten, what war is like. So once again, you get all these people who are calling for rapid solutions to situations instead of trying to learn from history. But as we know, those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat it.
I would love to be a fly on the wall and hear a conversation between Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, his foreign minister. These two people are, well, no matter what anyone thinks about them, they're very well-read historians. And I can't imagine what they think, what it is like for them to sit down across the table from someone like Donald Trump, a failed businessman, because, you know, he's done very poorly with the millions he was given. And the man is a Philistine. I use that word advisedly. And these guys, Putin and Lavrov, have to sit across the table and discuss pressing global issues with them. It must be dystopian for them.
Well, it's interesting that both Russia and Germany also, they suffered such enormous losses, tens of millions of people during World War II, that the collective memory in these countries is still very strong. And they are trying to be careful, but in the West, well, whether it's U.S. or Canada or and Australia and so on, well, we have sent troops overseas, and many of them didn't come back. But they were not raised down to the ground the way which large parts of Europe have. So the collective memory in Europe is such that there is a great resistance towards war, nuclear war. But
I am fully aware of that issue because I had the good fortune to fall in love with a beautiful German woman, and I lived in Germany for a while. And as a slight mistake that got made between, or a fight that developed between Rajiv Gandhi and the New Zealand Prime Minister, that Robert Muldoon, I got deported from India to the Soviet Union in the mid-80s. And I was treated really well in the Soviet Union for the couple of days that I stood there before I got shipped back out of the country. I didn't get sent to a salt mine in Siberia, but I did interesting conversations in both of those countries with older people who are completely conversant with the dangers of war, and they are really opposed to it. And there's that age-old saying that it's only people who haven't been to war who want to send other people's children off to war.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. It's a memory of individual and collective memory. Well, you had some incredible experiences, a very interesting life.
Yeah, it is. It's been a wonderful ride, and unfortunately, I'm spending the last part of it chronicling the unraveling of the biosphere. But I feel like I have a moral obligation to do it, both to the youth of the world, but also to Gaia, to the planet. The planet has been so wonderful to me. I'm in debt, and I'm going to try and settle that debt before I leave.
Yeah, you really ought to write a book, from what I understand.
Well, I have a whole lot of short stories and I've never really published them, but I'll motivate myself and I'll do it. They're all on a theme called Brushes with Death because I've had so many over so many years. So, yeah, I should put it together. Thank you for your motivation. Hey, one thing I'd like to discuss is in the book, you talk about the Chinese nuclear tests at Lop Nor. And I quote you, according to Dr. Toti, a Chinese medical doctor of the 1964-96 nuclear tests may have resulted in the deaths of a few hundred thousand people as a consequence of radiation produced from at least 40 nuclear explosions. Now that's the end of quote. I find it incredible that the nuclear industry have been able to cover up the level of deaths associated with the folly. If you go to Wikipedia, you won't see anything remotely like that number, that death toll. If you go and look on Fukushima Daiichi, it'll say there's only a few people died. Whereas in Japan, there was a massive spike in stillbirths and babies being aborted. And those people died as a result of Fukushima Daiichi. So, it's very difficult for people to know how bad the crisis is in every respect, unless they go to alternative media and critique it very carefully and find people who are joining the dots and pointing it at it rather than looking at things in isolation.
Well, that's right. This is a long-term, a medium to long-term effect, and they're not always being followed up or monitored. And of course, the nuclear industry and their supporters and government—they don't want these long-term results to be monitored. But it's true that there are now large territories of land around Chernobyl and around Fukushima and elsewhere, where levels of radiation is far too high, well above the what's called considered to be the safe limit.
And if you go to Japan, if you have a look what they've done of changing those safe, supposedly safe limits, since Fukushima Daiichi, that what the acceptable level of ionizing radiation or radionuclides is enormously. What it was 7 years ago before the disaster, or the triple disaster, and what it is now, there's no relationship between them whatsoever.
No, well, there are levels which could only affect people's genetic makeup in the long term, like 2 millirads or so. But the level for industrial workers, of course, are much higher, 50 or so. And the results are not immediate and not obvious. So you really want to read what the medical science writes about it. But there will be all this vested interest to say that there is no worry. There always will be. Once again, just follow the money.
Follow the money. It's a mantra we need to observe all the time. Hey, I am a little interested in what you said with regarding humans being some pockets of humans surviving, and that you thought it was more likely to be in the northern hemisphere. I would have thought the bottom of South America and the bottom of New Zealand would have been possibly two of the places that would have held out longest with habitat as a result of us having the biggest part of the cryosphere nearest to us. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, the Arctic is one huge region where people could survive as far as temperatures go. There are other factors, the effect on wildlife and radiation and so on, it's hard to predict. But you're right, the southern tips of Patagonia and New Zealand are also places where humans could survive. And there also are high-rise ocean islands. The atolls, the low ones, would be overtaken by sea level rise, but they are also volcanic islands. People, I think, are so adaptable. Well, many people are so adaptable, especially those who have kept a native culture and live off the land. To a large extent, some will survive. I mean, I don't want to indulge in any total scenarios. It will be terrible enough as it will be, but to say that everybody will perish, that's not based on any... it's not based on real estimates. When you look at the history of prehistoric humans, they have withstood the most severe climate catastrophes, especially during the Ice Ages, that you will have to respect the ability, the talent of human or some human to survive. But what will happen after they survive? Will they once again be able to multiply and extend to other parts of the earth? Well, this goes much further than you can really predict.
I think what that dichotomy discussing whether it's total extinction or just a massive fall off in the numbers will depend very much on the unknowns in the climate system that we don't know. We know a lot of things. We know the situation is dire, but there are a lot of unknowns as well. Hey, Andrew, we're winding up now. We're coming to the end of our interview. I'd like to thank you very, very much for giving us your time. I really would like to recommend to everyone that they read or get a copy of your book, The Pleistocene, Blueprints of a Post-Anthropocene Greenhouse Earth. And in summation, I'd also like to thank Afrozen for his theme music for the show. And thank you all for spending this time with us. Go well, Andrew.
Thank you. Yeah, well, thank you. I'm impressed by your experiences. You sound like someone who has really achieved so much in your life. So good on you.
Sir, thank you very much. I'll post this interview when it's uploaded by prn.fm. I'll post it on my blog site, and I'll include all the relevant links to information that we've discussed and the extra ones that you sent me. Thank you very much for that. Go well, sir. Look after yourself.
Yes, thank you. I look forward to get the link to your program.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you then. All the best.
Bye. Over to you, studio. Thank you. Have a great extinction, everyone.